coming back to trivial and mundane, when you start looking at heart disease risk factors, about, again, when I was in medical school, everybody said type A behavior. You know, type A behavior is what makes you have heart attacks. Type A behavior is characterized by these characteristics: hard driving people, competitive, need for recognition, time pressure, deadline pressure, hypermental and hyperphysical state. And of course, then all kinds of programs were introduced once again to reduce type A behavior. And what happened is people had even more heart attacks. So, in fact, nobody believes that type A behavior is related to heart disease. But there is one component of type A behavior which is related to heart disease, and that is hostility. And there are many, many studies now, especially from Duke University, from other centers in the world, that say this is the risk factor for heart disease. This and one other. I'll come to that in a moment. But this is the number one risk factor for heart disease. Hostility. This was an interesting study. 20% of hostile lawyers were dead at the age of 50. And a prospective study that was done. There are studies that have done angiograms and so on. And these are the three components that are most important when you examine people with hostility: a general cynical mistrust of others, a state of free-floating hostility, and frequent behavior patterns of aggression. Cynical mistrust, free-floating hostility, and frequent aggressive behavior, aggressive responding to people. Now, in your syllabus, we have actually done a little test, so you might be able to measure your own hostility level. You might want to look at that later, okay? Not right now. There are studies that show that when people feel supported, when they feel loved, when they feel cared for, that will immediately reduce the risk factor of death from heart disease. So there is this amazing study where a monthly phone call by a nurse to post-infarction patients, just one phone call lasting less than a minute, the nurse calls up the patient, says, "Mr. Smith, we are thinking of you. We want you to know that we are always here for you. We care about you. We love you." That will reduce the death in a post-infarction patient by 50%. Imagine if you had a drug that did that, you didn't use it, you'd be sued for malpractice. And yet this will do that. There are other studies, of course, that show that loving support by a spouse will reduce the incidence of post-infarction death. A study from Israel where patients were asked after a heart attack only one question: do you think your wife loves you or not? If the answer was yes, there was an 80% better survival rate. The second most important risk factor for heart disease is job dissatisfaction. More people die in our civilization on Monday morning at 9 o'clock than any other time. And that's an extraordinary and very unique accomplishment for which only the human species can take credit. Because presumably no other animal knows the difference between Monday and Tuesday. So here again we see that the fear that's generated by people in their consciousness, because they hate what they're doing, they have no purpose in their job, they do not get fulfillment, accelerates the whole problem. Just for completion, I'm going to talk for a few minutes on diet, because over the years I've personally become convinced, don't ask me why, and a lot of it has to do with my interactions with patients, and measurement of cholesterol, I've personally become convinced that diet has very little to do with heart disease. And, you know, I probably would be crucified by the establishment for saying this. But it's so difficult to, first of all, change people's diet. You're a different kind of group. You're very inspired. And that's your motivation for changing comes from inspiration. So you're learning about Vata, Pitta, Kapha, and you think this is wonderful, and there's a lot of joy in doing that. You'll do extremely well, and your diet will in fact change your physiology. But if you do that to someone out there who's not motivated, who's not inspired, and you tell them, better change your diet, otherwise you'll get into trouble, it's not going to work, I'm telling you, even if they follow the diet. It has to come from deep inside, that need for wanting to change. So in a clinical practice, when you give people diets, and I've done that over the years, and forced them to change, even things like cholesterol and all don't change. Because their whole psychophysiology is such that you start to secrete neuropeptides that transfer the cholesterol into a different metabolic pathway. And also when you give drugs, powerful drugs like Mevacor and other cholesterol-lowering agents, the reduction in cholesterol is not that significant, 10%, 15% at most, which is hardly what you want in people who have really high cholesterol levels. So there's limited success. Dr. Dean Ornish has been able to reduce stenosis, you know, coronary artery disease, as measured by angiography, by 40% in patients whom he puts them on a diet which has only 10% fat. Now that's very impressive when you look at that, but then go ask Dr. Ornish, how many people stick to that diet? It's a very small component of people who are very highly motivated, and they are actually offering a lot of loving support to each other. By and large, for practical purposes, it's totally impractical. So, diet is important, but the motivation for change in diet has to come from another level. And think, you probably heard me talk about this many, many times, you know, this classic study that was published in the journal Science in 1970, where scientists were feeding diets that were extremely high in cholesterol to rabbits. But in one group, the technician who was feeding these rabbits, he would take them out of their cages, he would pet their rabbits and cuddle them and tickle them and kiss them before feeding the same poisonous diet. But now as a result of that, they had a very significant decrease in fatty deposits, in atherosclerosis, and a much lower incidence of heart disease. So just the act of cuddling and touching and loving these rabbits changed the metabolism of cholesterol. And today there is data, good data, that shows that meditation twice a day will lower your cholesterol much more significantly than any change in your diet. That accountants will have their cholesterol levels go up by approximately 40%. Before tax time, because they feel all the deadline and the pressure and the frustration of having to do all this work in such a short time. Many studies that show that your mental state is more important in lowering or exacerbating your cholesterol levels than anything else. From an Ayurvedic perspective, the most important thing that you can do to prevent heart disease is to get in touch with dharma, your purpose in life. The understanding of what your unique talents are, because everyone who has life has a unique talent. There are no spare parts in the universe. That's the Vedic concept. And when that unique talent is expressed in service to others, that translates into an extremely healthy physiology. If you know, every organization has its mission statement, and our organization, Infinite Possibilities, we went on a retreat a few years ago with all our teachers, and we spent a week coming up with our mission statement, ended up with just four words: to heal, to serve, to transform, to love. And I think, you know, if you really think about it, that I can't think what would be anybody else's mission. That's probably everyone's mission, at least I think, to heal, to love, to transform, to serve. If that is our dharma, I think that in itself is more than enough. We'll move on now to a very interesting area. that fascinates me a lot, and I want to talk about it a little bit as it pertains to heart disease. One of the things that physiologists have become aware of in the last several years is that our bodies, our physical bodies, are magnets, and they are part of the magnetic field of the earth. That everything in our physical body has electrical or electromagnetic energy. We know that there are only four types of energies in the universe: electromagnetic energy, gravity, strong and weak forces. Electromagnetic energy seems to be all pervasive, it's everywhere. The Earth is a magnet with a north pole and a south pole, and there are lines of electromagnetic radiation that surround the Earth and permeate the fields of our atmosphere. Our physical body is also a magnet. Everywhere that we see, for even the DNA has polarities. It has a north pole and a south pole. Our heart has a pacemaker from where the electromagnetic energy emerges. Our brain waves produce electricity. Nerve impulses are transmitted through electromagnetic waves of energy. So each cell in the body has its own electromagnetic energy that it generates. In the human body, the two places where electromagnetic energy is generated very significantly, it's generated everywhere else as well, is in the brain and in the heart. One of the properties of that electromagnetic field is known as coherence. Coherence. Coherence is a quality of either heart wave or brain wave or the electromagnetic waves of any part of our body. Brainwave coherence, for example, is defined as the constancy of relationship of brainwaves at a specified frequency when they're measured from different parts of the scalp. When you record an EEG, you can record the brainwaves from different parts of the scalp at a certain frequency. And in most people, you'll find that there is no constancy of relationship, which means this part and this part and this part, they all have their own chaotic activity without any relationship to each other because of a turbulent internal dialogue, basically. When you have high brainwave coherence, which means there's constancy of relationship, which means the brainwaves are marching in step to each other, they have a relationship to each other, then there's creativity, there's alertness, there's better memory, there is better healing ability, there is better attention span. All these things correlate with high brainwave coherence. The heart actually also generates its own electricity. And the part of the heart that generates the electricity is called the pacemaker. It's found in a place, it was located in one of the little chambers of the heart called the atrium, and that place from where this electricity is generated is called the sinoatrial node. And then the electricity spreads out from there into the two chambers that are called the atria, and then into the ventricles, and that's the electricity that makes the heart pump. Over the years, people have had insights that actually the heart is the master oscillator of the body. It is the seat of this electromagnetic intelligence, if you will. You can take a human heart or any heart out of the body, give it the right nutrients, put it in the nice medium where all the nutrients are supplied, and the heart will continue to beat even outside the body. It's independent, in a sense, of what's happening in the body. You provide the right nutrients, the heart has its own automaticity, it has its own intelligence, and it will continue to beat forever if you give it the right conditions. So it is the master oscillator of the body. It generates this electricity that makes it pump, but it also creates an electromagnetic field around it. There are technologies that allow you to measure the coherence of the electromagnetic field around the heart, which spreads into the whole body, incidentally. There's a instrument called Fourier analysis. What it does is takes the electrocardiogram, which is the normal way to measure the electrical activity of the heart, and you put it through this computer analysis, and that electrocardiogram will then be translated into this electrical field that you can actually see and observe and measure and see the coherence of. The coherence of the heart and the coherence of the brain, when they're both coherent, that creates a coherent electromagnetic field around the whole body. And there is this suggestion that a coherent electromagnetic field around your body that constantly reorients itself to the electromagnetic fields of the earth and also ultimately of the planets and of the cosmos, that if your body is totally coherent in terms of the electromagnetic field it has, and if it's constantly, you know, reorienting itself in different locations in space and time to the electromagnetic fields of the earth, so it remains in this coherent phase with the energies of the earth and with the cosmos, then that's a state of zero entropy, no aging. The cells are perfectly aligned to the cells of the universe of which we are a part. But of course that doesn't happen all the time because, you know, we are disrupting our biological rhythms and there's so many factors that are influencing it. However, that's the scientific premise of what creates an aura. You know, in Vedic literature and all the spiritual literature, there is all this literature about an aura around a person. The aura is nothing but that electromagnetic field that's being generated. Different disease states, different kinds of auras, different states of awareness, different kinds of auras. But the healthier the aura is, which is, means the more coherent it is, then the more in alignment it is with the intelligence of the universe, the higher the state of awareness. The higher the state of awareness, the more access to that realm of creativity, that infinite mind, that cosmic mind that we have access to. So there are many techniques in yogic literature, in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, in the Shiva Sutras, the great ancient writings, which tell us about these auras, these subtle bodies, beyond the subtle body, the causal body, that are more in the realm of information and energy than in the realm of matter. There is another quality of the heart that is being measured right now, and it's called heart rate variability, which means that you measure the, and this is a little technical, you measure the RR interval. RR interval means the interval in an ECG between one heartbeat and the other heartbeat. And if this heart rate variability is increased, which means there's more chaos, then you're likely to have a more coherent electrical field. In other words, at the very, very basis of everything, there is a deterministic chaos. It's the deterministic chaos in that field of infinite flexibility, in the field of spirit, that ultimately creates coherence. Order comes out of chaos at very primordial levels. All kinds of order, physical as well as, you know, Nietzsche had this great phrase. He said, you must have chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star. And that's so true. Dancing stars are in fact born out of chaos. And Rumi, the great Sufi poet, was once asked, what's the secret? And he said, I'm in astounding lucid confusion. And it's also a state of liberation, freedom. So all this is measurable. And there are ways that your consciousness can influence this in the direction of chaos You see, that chaos is in response to the constantly and ever-changing dynamics of your body. If your heart rate was always 50 or 60, it has to respond minute to minute to all the different things that are happening in your body. More that heart rate variability at the primordial level, RR interval, the less likely you are to have an arrhythmia or anything like that. It's a prognostic factor. Dr. Walter M. Boritz, a senior Stanford physician who specializes in aging, has coined the term disuse syndrome to describe how negligence in paying attention to the body's basic needs, particularly the need for physical activity, can destroy health and lead to rapid premature aging. It's a well-known principle in physiology that any part of the body that falls into disuse will begin to atrophy and wither away. Boritz extended this principle and discovered that this effect was body-wide, spreading beyond the cardiovascular system. When a person decides to give up physical activity, he essentially invites his entire physiology to atrophy. As a result, a constellation of problems appears. The heart, arteries, and other parts of the cardiovascular system become more vulnerable. The muscles and skeleton become more fragile. Obesity becomes a high risk factor. Depression sets in, and signs of premature aging indicate that the body is biologically older than its calendar years. These are the five components of Boritz's disuse syndrome, which can be observed in countless older people today. The physical deteriorations on this list are not surprising, but it seems unusual that being inactive in and of itself would lead to depression, long considered a disorder of mood or personality. However, studies from the Russian space program have found that young cosmonauts subjected to the forced inactivity of spaceflight fell prey to depression. When put on a schedule of regular exercise, their depression was avoided. The brain mechanism that controls depression appears to lie with a class of neurochemicals called catecholamines. In depressed patients whose levels of catecholamines are abnormally low, healthy levels can be restored by giving antidepressant drugs. But the natural way to accomplish this is through regular exercise. Being holistic, exercise sends chemical messages back and forth between the brain and various muscle groups. Part of this flow of biochemical information stimulates the production of catecholamines. Thus, whenever a doctor writes a prescription for an antidepressant, Dr. Boritz declares, he is handing out a proxy for the body's own inner prescription, which is filled by exercise. The news that exercise offsets aging has been well publicized, although its preventive effect on depression may not be as well known. What is far more fascinating, however, is that the underlying logic that function precedes structure can be extended to say that awareness precedes function. The parts of the body that age, in other words, that lose structure, are not just the ones that are losing function by not being used enough. The person has also withdrawn awareness from them. Negative attitudes originating in the mind can also have powerful effects upon the body. The list of aggravating causes, from misuse of medications to alcoholism and depression, all begin with a weakening of awareness. In most cases, the ultimate solution doesn't lie with medicine, but with personal change. Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer has demonstrated that people in nursing homes improve remarkably after altering their lives in the simplest ways, giving them a potted plant to tend, allowing them to make up their own menus and taking charge of tidying their homes, instead of being passive, lonely dependents, playing the role of old folks in a nursing home, these people regained a sense of usefulness and worth. Bringing awareness into contact with frozen patterns of old conditioning starts to melt those patterns, for ultimately everything we can sense or think about is simply an aspect of our awareness.
the discomfort the body manifests as pain, numbness, spasm, inflexibility and trauma are all knots that awareness can undo by itself. Awareness is a healing power. It restores balance wherever it is allowed to flow freely. Through practice and dedication, you can heal any imbalance in the body-mind system through awareness, once the appropriate techniques of relaxation, release, and insight are learned. On the next tape side, you will find some exercises to help you call upon the power of awareness. These exercises are designed to prove that you can consciously direct the flow of energy and information in your body, and that there are major benefits to be gained from this. You can tap into subtler levels of information in the form of bodily cues you may have been ignoring. Your body will tell you what it needs when it needs it, the exact opposite of being driven by habit, which will never precisely fit the body's true desires. There are really two aspects or components of awareness: attention and intention. Attention focuses awareness to a local perception. Intention brings about a change in that localization. Through the power of your own awareness, you can focus attention on parts of the body that are expressing discomfort, and then by localizing your intention on the source of pain, you can cause healing to begin. As remarkable as it may seem, there is no magic in any of this. We all pay attention to various things throughout the day, and we all carry out various desires and intentions. The only magic is in the power of your body to respond to changes in your awareness and to manifest those changes in order to defeat the aging process. Again, we'll see that the quality of life depends on the quality of attention. Whatever you pay attention to will grow more important in your life, and there is no limit to the kinds of changes awareness can produce. By tuning into the energy and information field inside us, whenever we experience a change in awareness, we obtain the power to shatter the trap of old conditioning that creates the aging process.
Primordial sounds are the sounds that nature uses in order to create form and phenomenon. We experience primordial sounds in our bodies. We experience primordial sounds in nature. We experience primordial sound as mantra. These are all different expressions of primordial sound. And sound has the effect of entrainment on our physiology. So let's see which sounds have been used by the different healing traditions of the world. If you do cross-cultural anthropological studies, you will find that there are certain things all cultures do in order to bring about the healing response. One is the use of sound and music, of course, and mantra or some form of chanting. Another is massage. A third is meditation. A fourth is prayer. A fifth is exercise of some kind. A sixth is breathing techniques of some kind. And a seventh is diet. And an eighth is herbs. Those are the classic traditional healing techniques that are found in all the cultures of the world. But when we look at sounds, we find that not only do all the traditions of the world use sound for healing, but they use the same sounds, the same, almost the same chants. It seems like we all have figured out in different cultures, in different wisdom traditions, that these are the sounds for healing. So the first category of sounds are the sounds of the alphabet. The alphabet in Sanskrit is called Matrika, the mother of language. Earlier I told you that Matrika, matter, meter, mother, they're all related. Music, measurement, time. And the letters of the alphabet are literally the sounds of nature, if you sound them out. And they are, in fact, the word that becomes the flesh. There are two kinds of letters in the alphabet: vowels and consonants. The vowels are non-local sounds. Non-local sounds means that they go in all directions. Unless you intend to localize them, they don't localize spontaneously. We'll see how we can use them, local and non-local. The consonants are local sounds. Each sound has information and energy because it has those two components, Shruti and Smriti. So let's take the vowels first. The vowels in English are A, E, I, O, U. In Sanskrit they are A, A, E, E, U, U, A, I, O, Au, Am, Aha. Let's start with the first vowel, A. So I'm going to show you how to do this, and then we'll all do it together. You take a deep breath, and as you exhale, you make the sound ah, and you let it go all over the place. So I'm going to do it first, and then you'll follow me the second time around. It's very simple. As you can, okay, and as loudly as you can. Let's do it together. Okay, now we'll do it once more. But this time, let's close our eyes as you do it. And as you do it with your eyes closed, feel what happens in your body. Let the sound just go through your whole body, permeate your whole body. So take a deep breath, close your eyes and start again. And once more, but this time, your eyes are closed, you're making the same sound, and you direct that sound to one particular location in your body. And that location in your body could be a place that needs healing. Maybe it's your emotions, in which case, direct the sound to your heart. Maybe you have a lot of fear, in which case, direct the sound to your gut, to your stomach, to your solar plexus. Maybe you have an ulcer, then direct it there. Maybe you have a fibroid in your uterus, direct the sound there. Maybe you have a neck spasm. So this time, direct it there. Just close your eyes and direct the sound mentally as loudly as you can, making that same sound loudly, and locate it in that particular area of your body and see if you can produce a vibration in that. Let's take a deep breath again. Now we'll use the sound A and do the same thing, mentally directing it to your body somewhere, which requires healing. Okay, so let's take a deep breath. A. Now we'll use the sound E, same way, directing it into one particular location in your body. Take a deep breath. E. again with O, direct it somewhere in your body. O. What you can do is you practice with these sounds every day, just these few sounds, and you try and locate them to different parts of your body, and you'll find that out of these, A, A, E, O, U, out of these five sounds, there's one that works better for you than any other. In that you can move it around in your body, you can direct it anywhere you want, you can produce a vibration with it. And then adopt that as your primordial vowel sound and start using that. Anytime you have a headache, direct it there. A muscle spasm, direct it there. You're feeling emotionally distraught, direct it to your heart, etc. And once you can do that efficiently and you can do that easily, then start practicing it mentally without making the sound loudly. Just mentally. You can just think the sound and direct it, and you'll see it'll have the same effect. But it needs some practice. The consonants can be directed to different parts of the body too. So the sound of the letter na, it goes to the inner ear, to the mastoid. That's a sound that's used for healing bone deafness, for getting rid of vertigo, for getting rid of tinnitus, ringing in the ears. So let's do that right now. Take your tongue and let it rest against the back of your teeth, and we'll make the sound na. If you're doing it correctly, you should be able to feel the vibration in the mastoid, in the inner ear. Can you feel that? So let's do it once more. The sound of the letter ma goes to the sinuses. Very good for clearing up your sinuses, if you have sinus headaches or sinus congestion. So let's take a deep breath and do it once again. Make sure you feel the vibration here. Sound of the letter H, which is known as Mahaprana, back of the throat breathing, Ujjaya breathing. That's that sound will immediately abort a bronchial asthma attack. If you have a bronchial asthma attack or you have bronchospasms, you start making that sound, get rid of it. Okay, so that's the sound of the letter H, the Mahaprana. The sound that is produced when you move the jaws here, ya, yu, ye, ya, yu, ye, ya, yu, ye. That mobilizes the temporomandibular joint, ya, yu, ye. Some people have a condition called temporomandibular joint syndrome, where they have tightness here, they get headaches, they get arthritis, etc. It's very good to produce that sound to loosen the temporomandibular joint. Ya, you, ye. Let's do it together. Ya, you, ye. Ya, you, ye.
Ya, you, ye.
Okay. The sound of the letter ka, ga, gha. Ka, ga, gha. Comes from the throat. If you make that sound and produce it many times over, that'll keep your vocal cords strong and vibrant. When people grow old, the voice also sometimes ages. It loses its vibrancy. But you can maintain the vibrancy by making the sound. Ka ga gha, 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 ka ga gha. A lot of singers, I've worked with some well-known singers, and they all ka ga gha all day long. Okay. Sound of the letter L is a lingular sound. Pa ba bha is labial. Every letter of the alphabet has a resonance somewhere in the body. In fact, your body is nothing other than the script of nature. That's why it's called scripture. It is that script, the sound, the word becoming the flesh. Now I just want Roger to demonstrate overtones to you, which can also be used the same way as the vowel sounds are used.
This is done by holding your mouth fairly round as though you had a ball in your mouth, and the lips are somewhat pursed. It's described as a rabbit mouth. It's not very attractive. And you can use any vowel sound, or the great thing with toning is you can really use any sound, I mean, just whatever feels comfortable to you, but you can use a vowel sound. That's usually easiest for most people. You make the sound with your mouth in that position, so the mouth is kind of like an echo chamber, and then you use your tongue to just move the tongue up and down to play the air as it's going through that chamber of your mouth, and you can play the harmonics and pick up the frequencies in there. Do you want to have a go? Okay, let's do it with the sound O. So just take a deep breath and then just O. With a little more practice. Practice in the bathroom and people don't think you're weird. Also, use the mirror, because then when you get the right shape of your mouth and the position of your lips and you hear the overtones, then you'll know how you're doing it and you'll be able to repeat it. Okay, thank you.
And you can then use these overtones and direct them to different parts of the body, ultimately even doing it mentally. So this is one way we make sounds. The other sounds that are used for healing are mantras. Mantras are primordial sounds. And there are thousands of mantras that have very specific effects. And also, there are sounds that are created by those who are experts in this field that balance your body type. So there are vata balancing sounds, there are kapha balancing sounds, there are pitta balancing sounds. These have been developed over thousands of years, and there's a tradition behind them. Sounds of nature are also healing sounds. A rushing brook, a stream, a waterfall, the ocean, they all have the effect of entraining your biological rhythms. And you can see the effects of these sounds, not only on the body, we can observe the blood pressure, heart rate, breathing, etc. But you can take the cells out of the body, you can look at immune cells, play the sounds to the immune cells in the test tube, and you'll see that the immune cells start generating healing chemicals. You can block the healing effect of sound by giving somebody Narcan. Narcan is a narcotic antagonist, which means when this healing is occurring through sounds, your body is generating endogenous opiates. Opiates are heroin-like compounds. But unlike the heroin that you buy on the street, these are endogenous opiates that are healing substances. They may be more powerful than any heroin you can buy on the street, but they are healing opiates. So sounds generate opiates, sounds generate tranquilizers. If you play sounds of tranquility, your body will make Valium. It will make diazepam. But it's the exact same thing that Hoffmann-LaRoche makes, but it's made in the right amount, just the right amount, so you don't feel like a zombie. It allows your cells to do their job in tranquility. A lot of science is coming around to recognizing that sounds can have profound healing effects on the body. And this happens because sound is metabolized by your body. And it's metabolized to your body and made into molecules. The word indeed becomes the flesh. There's a lot of research that shows that the information that we take in through our sense of sight also very profoundly influences what's going on in the body. In fact, any sensory input that you have changes the body's chemistry in less than 1/100th of a second. So when you see something, when you hear something, when you touch something or taste something and smell something, the brain chemistry, but simultaneously the body chemistry responds to that in less than 1/100th of a second. If we knew that, then we would choose the appropriate input that could influence the chemistry in a favorable direction. There is research, for example, that when people look at a natural scene versus an urban scene, that there are different brainwave patterns. If you are out there looking at a natural scene such as a forest or a sunset or a rainbow, then your brainwave will show very distinct patterns that are quite different from the patterns that would come out if you were, say, seeing a violent crime or even an industrial plant or even a parking lot for that matter. So what you see immediately influences what's going on. And in fact, again, there are many research papers now coming out in many journals that show that our experience of sight can influence heart rate, blood pressure, stress hormones, and so on. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is go over a series of procedures that you can do with the eyes that will in fact improve your vision, improve your sense of color perception, and also allow you to experience and access different states of information in your consciousness. Because after all, through our senses, we are accessing information in that field of information, which is us. 99.99% of that empty space which makes up our body is nothing other than that field of information. And we are accessing that field of information through our senses. So let's take a series of procedures with the eyes that you can perform that will immediately result in enhanced sensory perception, will improve your eyesight, will improve your sense of color perception, which gives you much more enjoyment out of life, will also improve your memory, your creativity, your attention span, and your learning ability. All these things are possible just by doing a few simple exercises with the eyes. The first one is very simple. It's looking at the sun with the eyes closed. you would stand in the sun and look towards it with the eyes closed, allowing the light to filter through the eyelids and ultimately stimulating the rods and cones of the retina, which are responsible for light perception. Now, if you don't have access to the sun because it's a cloudy day, then you can also use full spectrum light. These days, full spectrum lights are available at most light stores. It just means that they have all the different wavelengths that sunlight has. And in fact, there's some very good research from England that was published in the journal Lancet, which shows that when full spectrum lights were used in classrooms, children started learning much faster, their grades improved, and not only that, they had fewer number of winter colds, fewer number of infections in the winter. Most of the lights that are used indoors are not full spectrum lights, and therefore are not really as healthy as the light that would have the full spectrum, which would be like the sun. The first exercise, simply looking at the sun with the eyes closed. This stimulates the cells of the retina so that they become more sensitive to light. The second procedure is called watching the colors, and it's a very simple thing. As you're looking towards the sun, you do that for maybe 15-20 seconds at the most. Your eyes are still closed. You gently massage the eyeballs with your fingertips, and you do that for about 15-20 seconds. After you've massaged the eyeballs, then you just gently move your head away from the sun and then back towards the sun or towards the full spectrum light, whichever you're using. And then you will experience in your awareness a whole range of colors. If you're a Pitta body type, you may experience more red. If you're a Kapha body type, you may experience more blue. If you're a Vata body type, you may experience more yellow and green. You will experience certain colors. And these colors are basically in your quantum mechanical body, because you're not perceiving outside colors, your eyes are still closed, you're perceiving colors that you're generating inside. And you just hold your attention in such a way that you try and maintain the experience of those colors. So once you've experienced the colors, then try to hold the colors in your awareness. And you may be able to do it for maybe 30 seconds or 60 seconds or sometimes for a minute or 2 minutes. And the colors change also. So spontaneously they may go through the full range of the spectrum, all the colors from violet to indigo to blue to green, yellow, orange and red. So you may see that. The idea of doing this exercise is that these subtle colors in our perception stimulate those cells of the eyes which are called cones, which are the receptors for color perception. As a result of doing this exercise, what happens is we find spontaneously, not because we're trying to, that suddenly the colors in our environment become much more alive. They become much more vibrant. They become much more powerful. Our sensory experience becomes richer as a result. We notice the colors more spontaneously. The same sunset viewed by two people could cause a completely different experience. In one person's awareness, rich, vibrant, full of color. In another person's awareness, dull. They're seeing the same thing, but if the light receptors are much more sensitive, then color becomes lively in your awareness, and that spontaneously has a healing effect also. Basically, what you've done is you've looked towards the sun or the full spectrum light for a given amount of time, 30 seconds. Then you've gently massaged the eyes while the eyes are closed. And then you just move the head back and forth towards the sun a few times, and then you hold the colors for as long as you can. The total time to do all the procedures that I'm going to go over will take you about 5 or 6 minutes and completely alter your sensory perception. And you do it every day. So now let's move on to some other procedures with the eyes that also are extremely useful. If you do the whole set of eye exercises, then not only can you improve your vision, but if you now have vision which is not normal, if you're short-sighted or far-sighted or have any other refractive problems, these can be corrected. You will notice as you do these procedures that after a period of time you'll need to change your lenses, and you may need to change them 3 or 4 times before you can finally discard them. So if you do these exercises regularly, you should be able to correct your vision. Ultimately, don't need any corrective aids. See, what we consider as normal in our society is many times the psychopathology of the average. And we confuse normal with average. The average is so common, so dull, so uninteresting, we don't even notice it. So when somebody comes along who has really normal sight, it appears extraordinary. With these exercises, by common standards, you may really develop extraordinary vision. The next set of procedures is for the lens of the eye. As people grow old, what happens is the lens becomes less flexible, it becomes rigid. And as a result of that, there's stagnation of fluid inside the lens that ultimately leads to densities and cataracts and so on. So by improving the flexibility, pliability, elasticity of the lens, what we can do is prevent cataracts from occurring in the future, as well as improve our vision and correct either short-sightedness or far-sightedness. There are three procedures that will help improve the flexibility of the lens. The first one is called focusing, and it's very simple. All you do is you look at an object which is close to you, and then you look at an object which is distant. So you could take your own hand, for example, and just hold it about a few inches in front of your eyes, maybe about 6 inches in front of your eyes, and you look at your hand, and then you look at an object in the distance. Traditionally, it used to be the horizon. So you looked at something which was 6 inches away from you, your hand, you hold it in front of you, and then you look at an object at a distance. You look again back at the object which is close to you, your hand, and then look again at distance. You do that 15, 20 times. There should be no strain, it should be simple and smooth. But as you do this, you change the focal length of the lens. And as you change the focal length of the lens, you increase its elasticity, its plasticity, its flexibility. The second thing to do to improve the flexibility of the lens is a procedure that we call distant reading. In this exercise, you take some written material and you can pin it up against the wall, and then you stand at a distance away from it as far as possible for comfortable reading. And then every day you move back just a little bit, very little bit, that will allow you to read it comfortably. And if you do that slowly enough, you will find that gradually you will be able to read it from the further distance. Till ultimately you should be able to read it from even the end of the room. Many times when I go on jet planes and I'm traveling, I look at the small print in the front of the aircraft when I'm sitting at the back. And just with practice, after a while, I can read the small print in the front of the plane from the back of the plane. As a result of just doing it. The opposite of distant reading is close reading. You take the same printed material and you read it from as close a distance that you can comfortably, and then gradually bring it nearer you every day till finally you can read it even if it's against your nose. So ultimately your range of vision extends from closer than the closest to farther than the farthest. These three procedures, focusing, distant reading and close reading, are all very useful in improving the flexibility and pliability of the lens. You do all the procedures just once. Every single procedure should take no more than 15-20 seconds. And when you're done with all these procedures, the whole thing should take you no more than 5 minutes. And also, it is important to bear in mind that if you have corrective lenses, when you do the procedures, it's best to take them off. So the next set of procedures are called fixed positions of the eyes, and these fixed positions of the eyes strengthen the extraocular muscles of the eyes. The extraocular muscles are those muscles which are responsible for movement and coordination of the eyes. Not only do they strengthen the extraocular muscles of the eyes, which is of course a very important aspect of vision and also of coordination, but they also allow us to access different states of information in consciousness, and by doing that they strengthen our memory, they strengthen our learning ability, they strengthen our attention span, and ultimately all of this leads to a much more stable physiology. So the first fixed position of the eyes is looking to the left and up. looking to the left and up, and you hold the eyes in that fixed position for about 15 seconds or so. You look straight ahead. First you hold your head so that your eyes are pointing straight ahead, and then without moving the head, you look up and to the left. Now this movement is a movement that people spontaneously make when they are recalling a visual memory. Let's say if you ask somebody, how was the picnic and who was dressed in what colors or what did she look like, etc. When you ask somebody that question and they're trying to recall a visual image, they spontaneously look up and to the left if they're right-handed people. And just doing this procedure, we strengthen our ability of visual recall. Looking down and to the left accesses auditory memory and auditory recall. So if you're recalling a conversation, or if you're recalling some music in your awareness, then you spontaneously, usually, look down and to the left. Now looking down and to the right allows us to access what is called kinesthetic recall, or the experience of touch, the memory of touch. So if you are recalling the texture of a rose petal in your awareness, then that's what you spontaneously do. Vata body types are sensitive to both touch and sound, so they tend to look down most of the time. Pitta types tend to look up, and they respond much more to light and to sight and form. And Kapha types tend to look towards their nose or towards their tongue in the center, because they're accessing the state of information that comes from smell and also comes from taste. So you can see how you can, even by looking at a person's eye movements, predict whether they're a Vata, Pitta and Kapha. If you look up and to the right, that's the position of the eyes that strengthens the ability to create new visual forms, such as a creative artist would do. If you look horizontally and to the right, that is the kind of movement a musician or a composer uses when he is creating new sound forms or new symphonies. If you look to the left and horizontally, that's the same as looking to the left and down, recalling auditory memory. If you stare towards your nose, then you strengthen what is called olfactory memories. Olfactory memories are the memories of smell and fragrance that we have. If you stare or just have the idea that your eyes are pointing towards your tongue, that accesses what scientists call gustatory memories, the memories of taste. So you can see that just by holding the eyes in fixed positions, we can access different states of information that exist in our own awareness. As a result of doing this, we strengthen our memory, we strengthen our ability to recall things, we strengthen our attention span, we strengthen our learning ability. And we have done research in our laboratories that show that when people hold these fixed positions, they have what is called increased brainwave coherence on EEG. If you see the EEG, it shows a completely different pattern where the brainwaves have entrained with each other, where the brainwaves show a rhythmic relationship to each other. This feature is called brainwave coherence. And we now know from a lot of scientific studies that increased brainwave coherence is in fact a very important factor in learning ability, in strengthening our ability to learn, whether it's memory or whether it's accessing any other visual information. Multisensory experience improves just as a result of doing these simple eye exercises and holding these fixed positions. A Vata person usually has better auditory and tactile responses. A Pitta person usually has more visual responses and therefore accesses visual memory much more than any other form. A Kapha person accesses more the memories of taste and smell. But I think if we just do all the exercises, it takes 30 seconds to hold the eyes in one position and move the eyes through all these different positions, start up left, then down left, then down and right, then up and right, and then horizontally to the left, and then horizontally to the right, then look towards the nose for 30 seconds, then turn the eyes inwards and towards the tongue, and then finally the last one is turn the eyes upwards and inwards, trying to look at the space between the eyebrows. And when you do that, then according to the ancient Ayurvedic tradition, what you do is you open up what is traditionally the third eye, which is the eye of intuition. And intuition is heightened awareness. It's just accessing information that normally people don't access. But after all, if consciousness is the field where all information is present, then you just access a little more information, then you become, by common standards, intuitive. Intuition is nothing but heightened sense of awareness. So doing these fixed positions allows you to improve all aspects of learning, all aspects of memory, ultimately makes for a richer, fuller, better life, and also a multi-sensory experience. So by replicating these eye movements, we strengthen those abilities, which are there anyway, spontaneously. So if you understand that matter or structure is the final thing, before matter is function, before function is intention, and before intention is consciousness. And from consciousness comes this whole thing. They say the eyes are the mirrors to the soul, the windows to the soul, because eye movements always reflect what's happening in consciousness.